Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we zero in on landscaping with native plants with Molly Fifield-Murray. Molly directs outreach and education programs for the UW-Madison Arboretum. Really pleased to have her with us today, and certainly if you have questions relating to native plants and landscaping with them, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org and send us an email. And Molly, nice to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry, as always.
What's going on at the Arboretum these days?
Oh, well, it's spectacular right
yeah.
now. This year, we're lucky to have a very nice fall color, and the prairie did not dry out. So we have both the very red prairie and the leaves turning on the trees, too. Usually the prairie starts in September and it's done by now, but it's still there. So
it's a great time to take a look.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, we already have callers on the line, but, you know, it seems to me that the more people are now using native plants, things like prairie smoke and blue-eyed grass and bloodroot and things like that. But they've often been overlooked, I think, a bit in the home landscape.
Well, it seems to have gone in cycles. There was a huge movement in the early 1900s up to possibly World War II, where they used a lot of native plants. Jens Jensen, who's quite mm-hmm. well known in this state
yeah.
and Illinois for his work in naturalistic landscape. There were clubs all over the country, friends of our native landscape. But then after World War II and the housing boom, they sort of ignored good landscaping principles and just plopped down plants as architectural features. And then we sort of lost track of it for a while until late 60s, early 70s, when people like Daryl Morrison and Lori Otto picked up the banner again.
Yeah. And so we're back in it again.
We are.
And it's good to hear it again. You can join us at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Robert's online from Nina, so let's go to Robert. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Glad to talk to you, Molly.
Hi, Robert.
Just a question. I have a garden that has kind of gone bad. I had a black walnut tree next to my garden, and so I just kind of let it go natural. And this past summer, for some strange reason, I had a plant that showed up in the middle of my garden that, upon research, I found was called boneset, and just kind of wondering how it got there.
Yeah. Well, how do these plants get where? That's always a good question.
Well, boneset is usually a sort of a wet prairie plant. And its seed is spread by air, so it's a parachute kind of seed, blows around. It's not usually a plant that we worry about, although my mother remembered her grandmother giving her boneset tea in the spring, and she said it tasted horrible. I looked it up once, and they said, it tastes horrible. So. But, you know, the seeds fly around, and once they get in an airstream, they can travel quite a distance. And, you know, it's not something that spreads vigorously or something to worry about. In fact, if you're lucky to have a native plant growing under your walnut tree, you're in good shape.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Prairie plants don't require typically a lot of fertilizer or pesticides, not necessary or recommended, maybe at the beginning, but what?
Well, you can start a prairie garden or even a woodland garden without any pesticides. It just takes a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly before the 1940s, people did all their farming and gardening without pesticides. We've just gotten a little impatient and don't want to do the handwork as much. The good thing about prairie plants is if you want to have a greener footprint on the earth, lower your carbon footprint, live in a sustainably way, you plant a native garden. You can even plant sort of an English cottage garden so that your fruits and vegetables are around there too. And you're reducing mowing, you're reducing use of water usually, and greatly, you don't need to use fertilizer. If you start a prairie garden, I tend to ask, you know, if it's a brand new house, I don't even want them to put topsoil back on a prairie garden, because topsoil usually carries weeds because it's been stored someplace, and prairie plants will get their roots down into the soil, and they sort of make their own fertilizer, and they use complex fertilizer, complex nitrogen. So the kinds of fertilizers that we use in our lawns are not even the kinds that prairie plants like to use. And you're really encouraging weeds if you do that, because most of the fertilizer are for plants that take up that sort of rapidly deteriorating nitrogen. So
yeah. All right. Bob in Iola, it's your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Hey, morning. Thanks for the show. I always find it very enjoyable. Hey, you just touched on walnuts a moment ago, and I maybe made the mistake of planting about 20 walnut trees about 20 years ago. They're starting to get pretty good size. I know the leaves are toxic to some things, like tomatoes. How paranoid should we be about these leaves? A few leaves in the garden, okay. Don't mulch with all leaves. Could you just elaborate on it a little bit?
I would not use walnut leaves for any mulching. In a vegetable garden at all. If you have native wildflowers, there are many of them that tolerate it. I'm sort of scrambling through my folder here looking for the list, but you can find the list online actually quite easily. So there are native plants that grow with walnuts, but I would be very careful about removing both the nuts and the leaves from any vegetable garden kind of area, because there's a chemical, Juglans is the genus name of the tree, and it's a very toxic chemical for other plants. It's not toxic to people. But, well, I don't know, actually. I've never eaten the leaves, but obviously people eat walnuts. So.
Black walnuts, yeah, which we have in abundance on, there's a black walnut tree near Agriculture Hall on the UW campus, and all those black those walnuts, those big old green covers are staining and all over the place. Man, it looks like a good year for black walnuts.
Right, and for squirrels and chipmunks and
yeah, for
everybody who eats them.
Yeah, for everybody who eats them. All right, Bob, thanks. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Celeste in Richland Center, we're on to you now as we talk about native plants. And Celeste, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling today because I have the necessity to move about 5 different rose bushes. They've been established for about 3 years. And unfortunately, due to putting in a new septic system, they have to be transplanted somewhere else in the yard. So I'm wondering if there's any fertilizers or anything that I can think about to use while I do this.
Are these hybrid tea or are they bush roses?
Actually, they're bush roses.
Okay. I like to use slow-release fertilizers for shrubs, and you can get packets that release fertilizer over 3 to 5 years at any quality garden center. And you just, once you dig the hole, you toss the packet in the bottom, put a little dirt on it, and then put the plant in. And that releases it slowly over time, and you don't have the possibility of over-fertilizing and creating a flush of new growth 1 year and nothing the next.
Okay, and now should they be covered during the winter also?
Shrub roses don't usually need to be. If you're just transplanting them, you might want to let the ground freeze, water them in really well, and then mulch after the ground freezes. Well, I put that in the wrong order. Water them, let the ground freeze, and then mulch.
Okay. All right. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And let's, we take more callers here online. How do you use native plants? And we'll get to those calls in a minute. How do you use native plants to create a sense of place you talk about?
Well, you know, if people travel around the country and see wild areas, you know that the Midwest has this spectacular array of plants that, what I think of the Midwest, I think of green.
Yeah.
And we don't have enough words in our language to talk about all the greens there are in the Midwest. From the very deep green of the oaks to the lighter greens of some of the other trees, the maples, and to the if you're lucky enough to see a native prairie, the colors and textures and everything in that. When you go to other parts of the country, the Southwest, you probably think, well, I think brown, but that's probably not fair for people who love the desert. But, of course, it is a different landscape. If you go to the Northwest, you think of conifers and and that color of sort of a one color. And this was brought home to me once many years ago. I came back from Alaska in June, and it was just such a stark contrast between the two places. And so when we start planting plants that aren't native here, like blue spruces everywhere, then you start to wonder where you are a little bit. So native plants can help you both understand where you are, and I think it's just a matter of appreciating that they're adapted to the climate here. Now, if the climate's changing, what's going to happen to them? Certainly the things that are more from the north are going to have trouble as the climate gets warmer. And but if you plant, that's one of the things for diversity in a planting is the fact that some of the things will do well and some of the things may not.
Yeah. Roland in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Roland.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was, I'm a person who doesn't know too much about nature. I know a lot about computers, but I've got grandchildren. We just moved here to Eau Claire to be by three of them. And I'd like to kind of get to the point where my grandkids would say, boy, my grandpa sure knows a lot about nature. So I was wondering what kind of resources might be useful, like when I go out for a walk in the woods with them, to be able to look at this particular tree, this particular bush, plant, whatever, and say, oh, this is, and then and be able to understand it a little better. I just was wondering what kind of resources are there, what would be a good approach to for someone who really is just starting.
Well, that's a good for you, by the way, Roland.
Yeah, well, that's a really neat question. And I think one of the things that you can do is just explore with your grandchildren and not worry about knowing anything and discover things with them and then show them how to learn. Actually, that's a little presumptuous of a statement, but help them learn with you. So if you're a computer guy, I mean, the neat thing you can do, there's some really nice websites. One is from the Freckman Arboretum at UW-Stevens Point, and then also the UW-Botany Herbarium here. You can, if you're looking at plants, for instance, you can bring in leaves or parts of the plants and key them out. I like to take photographs rather than plants and look to key them out by looking at those websites. So if the kids are interested already in technology, that's a nice way to meet the two. You know, if you're seeing birds and you don't know what they are, you can go to the Cornell websites. They even have the bird calls and then show you the birds. There's also a wonderful DVD about the birds of Wisconsin that shows them and plays all their calls.
Recently I found a beetle outside my house. It was interesting looking. I actually went to the internet, beetles of Wisconsin, and I actually located this thing. It was a carrion beetle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to I like to take photographs, and I like to take photographs of flowers, and all of a sudden there are all these insects on them, and then I had to start learning them. And so I've used mostly the internet. There are some nice books like Butterflies Through Binoculars. The Little Golden Guides are wonderful books. You know, you think they're for kids, but the Golden Guide Pond book is probably the best one for any beginner. And if you get more complicated than that, you know, you're starting to get into some sort of difficult science things sometimes. The fact that you knew it was a beetle is a good deal because, you know, there's lots of different orders of insects. And just learning that something's a bug, something's a beetle, something's a flies. I mean, when you start looking at what's pollinating flowers, there's flies, but they look like bees. There's bees that look like bees. There are wasps that look like bees. So you think the bees are pollinating, but actually there are all sorts of different creatures. Mm-hmm. So exploring with your kids is great. Mm-hmm. There's a neat book called Walk When the Moon is Full by Fran Hammerström. She was a well-known naturalist that helped save the prairie chicken in Wisconsin, and she would take her kids out on the full moon year-round and just explore something that was important that month. So things like that, there's nothing. Rachel Carson said the most important thing to develop a sense of wonder in a child is to have an adult to share it with. And the fact that you are wondering at the same time is just a wonderful model for them.
Yeah. And good luck and have a lot of fun, Roland.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Molly Fifield Murray, our guest today. We're talking with her about landscaping with native plants. Have a question? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, you're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking landscaping with native plants with Molly Fifield Murray. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. And regarding that black walnut is all parts of the black walnut can be toxic. Leaves can be quite toxic, and it's especially a problem with horses, can lead to laminitis, according to one of our callers. So, you know, they're all kind of all parts are a problem. Just so we know that.
Well, there are other trees that are problems for horses. Black cherries, for instance, have cyanides in the seed, some trees are toxic to humans, like black locusts. If you're cutting them, the sawdust is toxic, so you have to be very careful around that. So I think some of those things our ancestors probably knew and we've forgotten.
All right. Well, John in New Berlin, our guest next, or our caller next. Hi, John.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I have some elephant ears that I planted this year, and they got quite big. And I was wondering, what's the best way to store those over the winter?
If you're talking about elephant ears, meaning prairie dock, Silphium terebinthinaceum?
Yes.
Or
the bulbs.
Yeah.
They're not bulbs. So if you're talking about a bulb, it's a non-native plant, and I can't help you.
If it's a bulb, it's got to be a non-native plant.
Yeah, it's a non-native, I believe, yes.
Okay, so all I know about bulbs like begonias and things like that, you're really stretching my knowledge here and going back to working with my mom in the garden, but you would clean them off, dig them up, clean them off, and store them in a cool, dry place, like for dahlias and begonias, you would do that. So I'm assuming this plant, but you really have to call back when somebody from Extension's here. I'm sorry.
Let's go to Val in the Hales Corners next. Hi, Val.
Hi, good morning. I have a question for you, Molly, about a taller variety that would grow under an oak tree. It would be like understory, and I'd like something that would grow about 10 feet high. The pagoda dogwood isn't doing very well there.
Oh, really? Pagoda dogwood should do okay there. They can tolerate quite a bit of shade. What's the soil like?
Usual Milwaukee area, mostly clay.
Clay.
But I've been working on it, and it's other things are doing well. Of course, the lily of the valley is doing great, and I leave the leaves on it and mulch them in, so it's getting better. But the high bush cranberry does okay, and then it gets that rot sometimes, you know, at the base.
Is it fairly shady?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, you could try something called button bush, and I'm going to give you the Latin for it because sometimes the nurseries might call it something else, but it's Cephalanthus occidentalis, that's Cephalanthus. It can tolerate a fair amount of shade, but it likes somewhat moist soils. There's also one called bladdernut that does okay in fairly well, not deep maple shade. If you don't want it to get too tall, maple leaf viburnum is a wonderful plant. Gets maybe 6 to 7 feet tall max, grows in very deep shade. It's a little hard to find in the trade, but they're starting, more and more people are starting to carry it because it is so good in shady areas.
Mm-hmm. I love the viburnums. I have a lot of them, and they're just so beautiful in the landscape.
Do you have nannyberry then?
I have that.
Okay.
Not there.
Yes.
Oh, and my other question is, what about digging around the roots of that oak tree?
You know, the mighty oak is very not so mighty when you're disturbing its root system.
I'm worried about that.
Yeah.
So start small.
Start small. Do only a maximum of a third of the tree at a time. You know, if you're creating a bed around the oak, don't do the whole bed at one time.
Okay. Okay, right. I'll look for those.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Someone else phoned in regarding our caller from Eau Claire, the grandpa from Eau Claire who called in, and with some more advice for him. And the caller said that he should go to Beaver Creek Preserve near Eau Claire to learn some more. You can learn a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
And to take along a magnifying glass or some magnifying glasses for kids to use when he's out in the field with the kids and walking around, and be sure to turn over logs
right.
that are laying in the ground and see what's underneath.
Yeah, logs and rocks. There's a wonderful book called Geography of Childhood that was written about 15 years ago, and they talked about how kids like to look at little things. And this fellow, Gary Paul Nabum and Stephen Trimble, were the authors, and one of them took their children to some place like the Grand Canyon or the Royal Gorge or something out west. And the kids were looking at the chipmunks and the little rocks, and the parents were looking at the vista. So young children in particular, say under 10, are most interested in things that are of a scale related to them.
Yeah.
And so the magnifying glass or letting them just peer around. One thing we did at our day camp this summer at the Arboretum is instead of having everything structured for them, we gave them time for free play in the woods, and we had a special part of the woods that we knew there wasn't anything, no poison ivy or anything, and the kid, that was the favorite part of camp, because we have structured children's lives so much that they seldom get to explore. So this grandpa will have a great time with those kids.
Absolutely. You know, that's true.
Makes me want to retire.
I tell you what, it's true of our five-year-old, too. Who, when we go to the zoo, the first place she wants to go is the Hurt Building. And so she likes to look at the snakes. But she also, there's an area in the building where there are the insects and all the different things you can look at under a magnifying glass. And she spends a lot of time looking at those small things under the magnifying glasses.
Yeah.
That's fun. Mary and Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I was wondering if there's something I can plant by my raspberries. I only have 3 raspberry bushes that I put in last year, and I planted them far apart. So is there something, some native plant I could grow that would not compete with them? Or am I better off just planting a few more raspberry bushes and not confusing the issue?
Well, wild raspberries tend to be a disturbance plant, and so what they grow with naturally are sort of disturbance species. But you could use a mixture of Pennsylvania sedge and wild strawberries under them. You're going to still get weeds, though, so you'll have to watch it because those two plants won't really control all the weeds that you might have.
But they,
okay.
But they would look
that
nice.
That should work. I can try both of those. Now, the wild strawberries, can I eat those berries?
Oh, yes.
Okay. I wasn't sure. And then
if
I
you
have
can
another
beat the turkeys
question,
too.
But I don't know if you can help me out. Last year, I brought my cherry tomatoes in the house by the and left them by the sunny patio window, and I had tomatoes for quite a long time. This year, I don't want to use that space up, and I was going to put them down in the basement with grow lights. Do you know how long I need to leave those grow lights on, approximately? Or I can just look this up online.
Grow lights for to get them ripe?
Yes.
Oh, No, you don't really need to do that. Some people wrap their tomatoes in newspaper for storage, and they ripen that way. You have to make sure they don't have any blemishes on them already, though, because if they have those little, I don't know the diseases very well, but there's a little black spot you can get on tomatoes.
Yeah, my tomatoes are infested with them, but it's basically my larger tomatoes, not my cherry tomatoes.
Okay. I would just lay them on newspaper in a cool, dark area, and they should be okay.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That's better than messing around with them all winter.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Mary. Appreciate your call. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Had an email from John relating to native plantings. He wanted people to know if you want to learn more about using native plants, the Wild Ones is presenting a conference at Cardinal Stritch University. That's tomorrow, starting at 8 in the morning. It's $30 and for most of us, and $15 for students who, if they have an ID, a student ID. And Jim Reinhartz, who is manager of the UWM field station at the Cedarburg Bog, will be one of the guests. And Bob Ehrenhoster, environmental educator. Wendy Walcott, land steward at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. And Dr. Dave Kapitsky, who is former curator of botany at the Milwaukee Public Museum, and some others. So if you want some more details, you can just go to www.4-wild.org. So it's 4-wild.org/CONF for conference. And you'll find out more information about the Wild Ones, which is a great group.
Yeah, and most of the Wild Ones groups around the state have conferences at different times of year. The Madison Area Conference that the Arboretum puts on was last month in September, and we put it on every September so that people can see the gardens that we have right at the Native Gardens at the Arboretum. In fact, coming to the Native Gardens at the Arboretum or at the Schlitz Audubon Center or the Green Bay University Garden there, and other places like that around the state is a good way to see a garden that you might want to replicate. We have 4 acres of new gardens at the Arboretum, so that's a good example also. So the Wild Ones in the Fox Valley usually have a really nice conference in January or February, I think. So that's something to look for around the state, too.
Absolutely. Well, Dan and Butternut's on board next. Dan, hello to you.
Yes. I wanted to just say years ago in Illinois, I had a cherry tomato bush, and it was getting close to fall, and I just took it and hung it upside down in a closet downstairs. And I opened up that door one day a couple of weeks later, and it was like looking into a fire.
Oh, wow. I've never heard that.
They all just ripened up.
Well, we had a little frost last night, and my husband and I didn't get out to the garden. We had picked everything about a week ago when we had that first frost, or 2 weeks ago, and we covered the tomatoes, but they sure aren't getting ripe outside because it's been too cool, so you might as well bring them in now.
Might as well. All right. Thanks, Dan, for calling. And Trudy in Rice Lake, we'll turn to you. Hi, Trudy.
Hi. I have a question about some mum plants. We had gotten some mum plants for my father's funeral, and I want to try to revive them for next spring. What do I do with them?
Let's see. What part of the state? I'm sorry. I missed.
Rice Lake.
Rice Lake. You're probably not going to be able to keep them, but you can try. They're not a native plant, so once again, I'm going on just my own gardening experience, and Larry can help me out. But actually, I've had mum surviving now for 3 years at my place, but for the 20 years before that, I could never keep them over the winter. And I don't know if it's just because the winters are milder. Of course, last winter, we had that blanket of snow. And that protected them. But they don't do well if we have an open, cold winter. So you can try it, but don't be disappointed if they don't make it.
Yep. All right. Good luck. Thanks. Mark in Antioch, Illinois, on to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, yes. I have some river birch trees in my yard, and every year we have a little problem with them. the leaves on the edges turn brown and yellow. And we've been told, well, maybe they're iron deficient or maybe you're not watering them enough. So I just wanted to get some advice on getting them healthy again.
I'm sorry, what kind of tree?
River birch.
Oh, river birch. And what's the soil like?
Well, we have, you know, a little harder clay soil. There is some sand lower down because we live on a lake, but a little harder soil.
Okay. They can be iron deficient, which would have to do with alkalinity of the soil more than anything else. But, you know, I would probably go to an extension agent or take the leaves into the state diagnostic lab or go online if you have access and look up those things. River birch are wonderful trees, and they can stand upland soils. We had them in the front of the Arboretum Visitor Center for years, and they are beautiful, and a number of people use them in the front yard, even as, you know, they're not a huge shade tree like a silver maple or something, but they're fast-growing, and they're beautiful bark and beautiful leaves. So I don't know the specific problem this might be, but you can get it analyzed if you want to spend that time, or you can just enjoy the variegation on the leaves. I don't know.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Patricia and Madison, on to you. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. For the women who just called in a few minutes ago wanting to keep some mums over till next year, I have found with some of these ones that one buys now just for color around the outdoors, I put them in the ground in an out-of-way place, and I pile soil over the top of them, mound them up almost like one does with the base of roses.
Okay.
And I have been able to save quite a few. And then I always put a stick by them so I know what I have there. And in the springtime, I'll start moving the soil away a little at a time. And many times I've been able to save them.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Molly Fifield-Murray directs outreach and education programs for the UW-Madison Arboretum, as we were talking. We've gotten on a lot of topics here. We're trying to zero in a little bit here on landscaping with native plants. So if you want to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And you've mentioned one of your first questions pretty much is always about soil. What's your soil like? And you really do, for native plants, it's probably a good idea to know that soil type.
Right. When you're thinking about putting native plants in an area, what you're trying to do is replicate the natural conditions as much as you can. And so you don't choose the plant you want to plant first. You look at the site first and see what plants belong there. And a really neat thing to do is see what plants were there 150 years ago, which anybody in the state can do by going online and looking up the survey records for their property. If they have their abstract, they can look up their township range section number and then see what the surveyors found when they came through the state starting in the 1830s. So what we do when we're planting a new area, and we do this with school kids, they love looking at the history, but the site might totally have changed. If you're lucky, it's still open, and there might be some old trees around that tells you what it used to be like. In southern Wisconsin, oak savanna was the most common plant community. There was prairie, but there were 7 million acres of oak savanna. But when you say prairie or oak savanna, there's maybe 5 different major types of prairie.
Yeah.
And the prairies that grew on sand are very different than the prairies that grew on limestone. The prairies that grow in wet places are very different than the prairies that grow in dry places. So the first thing to figure out is how much sun do I have, what's the soil like, and what plant community would have grown here naturally. Then you probably have a couple hundred species to choose from for your garden. And you can choose 30 or 40 species that give you a changing color all year. You know, the people who I love mums too, but you can get fall color with prairie plants, with the asters. New England asters still in bloom. And also the fruits of things are quite spectacular right now, whether you're in the woods with Fault Solomon seal, which is bright red right now. Jack in the Pulpit, red berries are very showy right now. But in the prairie, we have a lot of color now with the color that comes to the stems of the plants. Mm-hmm. So you don't always have to have one thing that stays blooming for a long time to enjoy color. And in fact, in native gardening, the garden's changing every week.
Every week, you bet. Well, Brian in Cedarburg has a question or comment. Hi, Brian.
Hello. I've got actually two questions relating to the plant Queen of the Prairie.
Okay.
And I've just had a new pond dug over a half acre, so I'm going to be planting the disturbed area around it. And of one of the plants, Queen of the Prairie, I've used this plant by planting the roots of it before. And I've now collected the seed. I've never planted the seed of Queen of the Prairie. What kind of success rate will I have with that seed?
Well, that that's hard to predict reliably from year to year. So it depends on how the pollination was and how the moisture was and whether the seed developed well. And then the other thing about native plants, and the really neat thing, is that when you collect a handful of seed of, say, Queen of the Prairie or Indian grass, they're little time capsules. And so the number of seeds that might germinate next year will not be the whole batch, because some of them are going to wait 2 years, and some of them might wait as long as 7 years to germinate. So you can throw the seed in a flat and get 20% germination and think, well, this is a failure. But, you know, you just have to wait.
Right.
A lot of the nurseries catalogs and most of their catalogs are online now, give you information on techniques to try to stimulate germination, whether it's wet stratification or replicating the conditions that the seed would naturally go through. So seeds that are ripe, say from mid-July through the rest of the year, need to go through a winter. And if it's a wetland plant like Queen of the Prairie, it probably needs to go through a wet winter.
Right.
So the best thing to do is try to replicate that. Many people do that in a refrigerator just to make sure they have everything controlled. And that's usually because they don't want to waste the seed. You can, some people like to throw seed out on top of snow, the last snowfall in the spring, and let it filter down to the soil with this, as the snow melts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people plant after burning, particularly if you're trying to increase the diversity of a site, because prairies have such, prairie plants are so bunchy that there's always soil in between them that you can add to once you've burned and cleaned up, so the seed gets down to the soil. I don't know if that answer helped you, but...
Yes. The other part of my question was, do you know of any locations where Queen of the Prairie grows in the wild in the Wisconsin area? I've never seen it in the wild.
I think it's marginally, it's not really a Wisconsin plant. It's a native to the Midwest plant, but not really native to most of Wisconsin. You can look at the herbarium website, and they will show you if there have been any collected in the state. They'll show you what county they were in.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking that Queen of the Prairie is more of an Illinois plant.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Molly Fifield Murray, our guest today, as we talk native plants with her. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking landscaping with native plants with Molly Fifield Murray. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you listening in. Email us at talk@wpr.org with your question, or call us at 800-642-1234. And Eileen emailed us, Molly, and she's... you mentioned keying in. She says, could you please explain how to key in a picture of a plant or insect to identify it? And also, what are disturbance plants?
Okay. It depends on what key you're using, what plant characteristics insect characteristics they're looking at. So a key is a guide to try to get you to a family for insects or genus for plants and then species. They're usually dichotomous keys. That means that you usually have a question that says, is the branching on this plant opposite or alternate? And then you choose one of those, and then you go to the next question, which might be something about the buds or something about are the leaves entire or toothed. Mm-hmm. And so you go through that, and it sort of filters you down to the right species. So there's not one key that works for every kind of thing, but most keys are dichotomous like that. Some keys are very broad, so we have a guide to the Prairie Plants of the Arboretum, and it just sort of shows you a picture of what iris looks like or what a composite looks like or something, and then you start in that family and work from there. So it doesn't get you down to the individual plant. It gets you to the plant family. For insects, you can get usually to the right order. And after that, I just look at pictures, frankly. You'd have to talk to somebody who knows a lot more. You know, if I get it to beetle, I'm pretty happy. And then I look at pictures to find out whether it's a locust borer beetle or something else and hope that I'm sort of close. But so you can't really – so if you have a photograph of a plant, you want to take both a picture of the flower and the leaves, because the questions that you'll find in these dichotomous keys are going to ask you about those things. If something is not in bloom when you're trying to figure out what it is, it's pretty tough. Yeah. And once again, you're going to end up looking at many different plants, photos, or, you know, get Prairie Plants of the Arboretum, which is a book that has most of the prairie plants in the state in it, or there's a new book from UW-Stevens Point about prairie plants, Woodland Wildflower books. There's a variety of them. There's national ones, and there's Wisconsin-oriented ones. So, but most of them have keys. Some of the keys are by color, but then the plant does need to be in bloom. So, some of the field guides will say, okay, is the flower blue? And if the flower is blue, you look there. The trouble with those kinds of keys is that if a genus has, like asters, for instance, have flowers, some species are blue, some are white, then they're not in the same place. And I find that a little confusing myself.
Yeah. And the disturbance plant, she wondered, what are disturbance plants?
Well, there are plants that are pioneers, and they are adapted for their seed germinating in disturbed soil, that is, soil that's been stirred up and the plant cover removed. So pioneer species tend to be somewhat weedy in our way of thinking. There are native weeds that are adapted to disturbance, such as ragweed, and there are non-native weeds that are adapted to disturbance, usually in gardens or farm fields, because that's where the soil is disturbed the most often.
On to Sarah in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to plant a rain garden in my floody backyard, and I have some questions for you. I've read about it, I think actually from a great piece on the Extension website, I can't remember. But I want to plant it with native plants. And I'm wondering what plants I should start with if you recommend a rain garden. And is it too late for me to start this fall in order to deal with the floods in the spring? Do I just have to deal with that in the spring? And then third, where can I get them inexpensively or cheap or free? I'm tempted to, like, go to rain gardens in my community and just start digging up the sedges and stuff, but I don't think that I should do that.
No, probably not. well, rain gardens are becoming quite popular. Actually, if the your property is already wet, that's not exactly where rain gardens are suggested to be, but you certainly can plant plants that will help absorb that water and transpire it away and help the conditions. grow better than a lawn, for instance, and you don't have to mow it. So we actually will be teaching classes in rain gardens at the Arboretum in the spring, and you can look online. It's not up yet, but I think it's going to be in March that we'll be offering some classes. There are rain gardens for the sunny areas and rain gardens for shady areas. I like to suggest looking at the community that you would model it on. If it's in sun, I would suggest a wet prairie. And if it's in shade, you'd think of a sort of wet woodland. And there, you know, so what do you have, sun or shade in your?
It's it's mostly shady. And but strangely enough, in that same area, there's this raspberry bush that does really well. So it's shady, but at some point it's getting enough sun for a raspberry bush to thrive. So it's a little confusing to me. But also, it's not wet all summer long. It's just during the spring.
Okay. Well, that's very typical of what would naturally have been a wet prairie.
Okay.
Or a mildly wet, like a wet oak savanna. Usually wet woodlands are wet most of the year. Although if they were along rivers, they were usually just wet in the spring. So there's a whole list of plants that you can use. Some of the extension publications that came out early on only have sunny woodland, sunny plants for rain gardens. But you can think of all the ferns that would love to grow there, and some shrubs like buttonbush and red osier dogwood, which is overused in the landscape, but that's its natural place, the kind of place you're talking about. And then wild ginger is a ground layer species that comes to mind, which would be in slightly wet areas like that. Sometimes naturally wet woodland streams, lowland forests, are a little bit weedy in our way of thinking because they get flooded in the spring and then something annual comes up like clearweed or jewelweed or something. So sedges would be good there. So if you're in Madison, correct?
Yeah.
If you came by the Arboretum, I could give you a list, or you could look online for some shady sort of. If you look at nurseries, they always have the moisture conditions that things do well in.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And Tom and Stoddard, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hi, Larry and Molly.
Hi.
Many of us know that during the wintertime we have winter kill because of the alternate freezing and thawing, and the roots become detached from the soil, and then they expand and burst. And I think that I have better luck with mums when I take the potting soil that they come in and either mix it with clay or else remove it and plant the mum in clay. And there's less heaving and moving of the dirt away from the roots. And I think that the other lady's suggestion of putting some dirt over the top of the plant is probably a pretty good additional solution.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. All right. Tim in Green Bay is up next. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about sumac, the wild tree-like shrubs that grow around.
Yes.
I have some on my property that I transplanted, and in some areas it spread like crazy, and I love that. That's what I want. I wanted to build like a natural snow fence.
Mm-hmm.
And in other ones for the last 5 years there's been just one single tree yet, and I'm wondering what causes them to spread and how can I get the ones that are single to start spreading.
You probably should patent it, the one that stayed single, because you know, that's fairly unusual. They're quite hardy and spread readily by you know, rhizomes or stolons under the ground. And so I'm not sure why. There's a number of species of sumac. There's staghorn sumac, there's smooth sumac, and they look very much alike. We've noticed this fall at the Arboretum that they're slightly different colors. And then there's another sumac that you don't see very often called fragrant sumac that's much more delicate in branching and leaves. But nothing's coming to mind for why that's not spreading. I don't know. What's growing around it?
It's just lawn, but I keep an area not mowed around it, you know, expecting it to start to spread.
Yeah.
Even like some of the stuff that is spreading, you mow it and it starts coming up right where you mow already.
Right.
I have two that one is probably about 7 feet tall now and hasn't spread, and the other is probably 5 feet tall and has not spread yet.
Huh.
And they've been there for years.
Yeah, you got me stumped. I don't know. I mean, sometimes it takes them a while to get settled in after being transplanted, particularly if they've been transplanted from the wild. And it's called transplant shock, and it takes them a while to start reproducing.
But that's usually within 5, certainly within 5 years.
Yeah, I would think so. So I don't know.
That's one
like
we can't help you with.
Patent that one and make your mint.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Molly Fifield Murray, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have Molly Fifield Murray as my guest. She directs outreach and education programs for the UW-Madison Arboretum. And we're talking about landscaping with native plants today. So I hope you'll join in. And Molly, we had an email from Lucy who's looking for ideas for native plants or shrubs to replace buckthorn in a dry woods area. It has mostly oak and hickory and large tooth aspen and black walnut. Has already used gray dogwood, pagoda dogwood, winterberry, but it's a 2-acre woods that we're looking working on, so we could use a lot of ideas. What have you got for Lucy?
Well, there's a lot of shrubs. Excuse me, there a lot of shrubs to diversify with. One, if there's some sort of open areas, there would be hazelnut that likes to be in open or very light shade. There are some of the viburnums that we mentioned earlier in the show, like nannyberry viburnum. I even have some elderberry growing in my woodland. You can do some small understory trees like ironwood could grow there. The bladder nut that I mentioned earlier, too, it's a little bit more unusual, but a very interesting woody plant. Of course, you can also plant ground layer species like columbine and blue wood phlox. The old field cinquefoil, if it's a little bit sandy, Solomon's plume, starry Solomon's plume, some of the woodland goldenrods.
There's, so lots there.
Yep.
She wonders if seed resources for dry woods. Quite a few of those, wouldn't there?
Yeah, most of the native nurseries now are not just prairie nurseries, right, but they have oak savanna and oak woodland species too. So depending, it's nice to get to ones close to you in the state.
Yeah.
So the DNR has a list on their website of nurseries. It's not completely up to date, but it would give you a start. And
yeah,
a local extension office would also have a list of nurseries near you. That's a good place to get seed.
Joan and Baraboo's up next. Hi, Joan. Thank you for waiting.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I had a couple suggestions for the lady that's trying to plant something under her tree, her oak tree. Things that I have growing under oak trees are the tall meadow rue, the very tall one.
Yes.
And I have Joe Pye weed. Those are probably about the height that she's looking for. The bottle brush grass would be fun to grow. Culver's root might grow there, and Solomon seal definitely would grow there. And I have fun with wild yam. I just happen to love vines, and wild yam is good. Let's see. Bladder nut is easy to grow from seed if you can get the seed, the bladder nut tree. And she should use very small plants, and I would think a witch hazel would be wonderful. Mine is under an oak tree, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger all the time, and it's wonderful. It'll be blooming soon.
Yeah, I think she didn't want it to be quite as big as that can get, but
That I think can be controlled with but with pruning.
Oh, well, yeah, but then you have to do some work.
That's true. And some of the dogwoods, I don't know about the gray, I think it's the gray dogwood that I have that produces fruit and also is under the, they're growing in my oak woods, so they're pretty neat. And I have a question. I've been trying for a couple years to grow buttonbush, native holly, and meadowsweet from seed. Can you give me suggestions on how to grow those? I have a great prairie propagation handbook, which was from the Ware Nature Center, and I realize now that it was last, my publication was from 1981 when I was a member of the Wild Ones down in the Mequon area, and it does not have information on those things. Can you give me any guidelines?
Well, one place to look would be the U.S. Department of Agriculture's website on plants, and they usually have information on how to get things started from seed, particularly for the buttonbush. They might not for the forbs, the wildflowers.
Well, the native holly is not a...
No, but the third one.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So,
the meadowsweet. Okay,
yeah.
I guess I was thinking more of it because it's a... More, it's a permanent bushy thing,
okay.
The way it grows
right
out here.
Anyway, the USDA site, there used to be a huge book you could get that talked about all these what woody plant seeds. They did a lot of research on it, and now it's all online. So,
is this something that I could go to look for if I could find the book? I don't have a computer. So
well, I would suggest a library computer because the book is... Well, I think the library computer would probably be the best source because I think a local library is not likely to have the book on how to grow woody plants from seeds. A university library may have.
Mm-hmm.
You could also check with nurseries to see if any of them have any of that online, but they don't usually for woody plants.
No, and especially native things. They're not...
Right.
They're just not, I guess... They're not well enough known for them to sell them commercially, which is sometimes a little bit frustrating. I did find a male holly plant for sale at Young's one year for $30, and thought, well, you know what? I think I'm just going to go back to gathering seed along my roadside here, my rustic road, and I keep planting it in the fall and hoping that something will come up. And, you know, I've been doing this for 5 years now and nothing's ever
nothing
come
comes up.
Well, the best thing to do with seeds, if you can't find any information on them, is try to replicate the natural conditions. And so the natural conditions for something that's a berry is that it gets eaten. The thing to do is remove the berry before you let it dry around the seed. Bladdernut, buttonbush. I don't know how much you have to remove the seeds from that button, replicating the conditions, some wild seeds, one reason you don't see some of the wild plants in nurseries is because they take 2 winters before they'll germinate.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the viburnums are that complicated. So they need winter, summer, winter, which you could try replicating in a refrigerator. But it takes a while, and I never have room. You know, move the moldy grapes out of the way.
I guess I enjoy the challenge, and I think they're the most beautiful bushes, and it's very disturbing for me to see aliens taking over the woods where my beautiful, bushy little wild hollies are. I think they're...
Yeah.
Well, I've been planting the wild holly also. I seem to be missing either the male or the female. I don't know which one, but I'm not getting fruit. And the buttonbush I've had for a couple of years, it's just getting bigger. There is a nursery in the state, Reeseville Ridge, which grows native trees and shrubs that are unusual. But you usually get them when they're very tiny. The Friends of the Arboretum plant sale has many of the native shrubs you're looking for. That's always the second Saturday in May. But if you're trying it with your own seeds, I would just look at the USDA website. And then if you can't find any information, just try to replicate the wild conditions as best you can. Mm-hmm. Like buttonbush is a wetland plant, as are the other two, and so they may need to not dry out very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Joan, for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get in here, and so we'll move on to Monica in Madison. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm fortunate enough to live in the neighborhoods and immediately adjoining the Arboretum in Madison, and I'm a big fan of the annual plant sale, but I wanted some advice about when you move species and plants that you buy from the Arboretum into a garden setting in a backyard. Some of them have turned out to be much more invasive than I expected. And I have one particular ongoing year, multi-year long battle with a prairie rose bush that I bought. And I'm wondering if you have some suggestions for if we want to incorporate them into a more contained yard setting, things to do to keep them from sort of overtaking areas of yard.
Well, one thing to do is plant them in containers and bury the container in the ground. So if you have a rhizomatous species like wild rose, prairie rose, or normally sumac, you can actually plant them in a container, and that would confine them right to that space. So I would make it a fairly big container so that it's probably somewhat bigger than you're buying it in from the plant sale, but a one-gallon container at least for prairie rose that you would bury, and it would confine it to that spot.
So they won't get root-bound and die off then? They just won't grow beyond a certain size if you do that?
Well, you could cut a hole in the bottom and see if it will go down the bottom but not have the root that goes laterally. It might do that. Or you might just have to replace them every now and then if it does get root-bound.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Gail in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Gail.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have an answer for the gentleman who was looking for Queen of the Prairie.
Yeah.
I worked at Ware Nature Center this summer, and they do have a fairly large plot of them up in their savanna area. So they bloom over the course of really only about two and a half weeks. So if the gentleman is near Milwaukee, he can see them. That's down in Whitnall Park.
Mm-hmm.
Or as he knows where that is. And as far as natives in the landscape, I have oval-headed sedge as part of my lawn, which is wonderful for the dogs because they can't tear it up, and it makes a very nice low. You don't have to mow it very often if you mow it at all. And then I have a brome that grows as an ornamental along the side of my house, and it was there when I bought the house, and I think it was used as an ornamental decades ago. Once it gets too heavy and falls over, I just cut it back, and then it greens up for the rest of the summer. So I'm hoping that some of those will be, helpful to some of you.
Well, I thank you very much, Gail. Good suggestions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, appreciate the call. And Mary in Belleville is up next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question about starting bur oaks. I've tried for several years to no avail. We have bur oaks on the property, some one that's probably several hundred years old even, but I can't seem to get the acorns to produce little trees for me.
And how do you go about trying?
Well, I put acorns in little pots with soil and sort of near the surface and keep them moist, and nothing happens.
Do you have squirrels?
No.
Okay, so you're pretty sure they're not getting eaten?
No, they're in pots. I start them in little pots.
Okay.
Oh, and you keep them indoors?
Well, right now I've got some out in the beside the back door, but they're outside.
I don't know why that's not working. We have been able to start bur oak at the Arboretum from some of our very ancient trees that we wanted to replicate.
Uh-huh.
And the oaks sometimes germinate. Some of them, I forget whether it's the whites or the reds, that germinate in the fall, and the others wait until spring. I'd have to look that up. I don't have that in front of me. I didn't bring that little piece of paper. It is important to have them be outside and go through a winter and replicate the natural conditions. It's important not to water them too much because you don't want them to rot.
Uh-huh.
Have you dug them up?
No, I just took them this fall. Several times I've done this in the past. I've picked them up off the ground, checked them for insect damage,
right,
and put them under a little bit of soil and waited, hoping that they would germinate, but they don't.
Okay, and when you look at them, have they rotted or what has happened to them?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nope.
Well, maybe
preserved.
Maybe they haven't been wet enough because the seed, the radical needs to be able to get through the seed coat and get out of the acorn. And so it needs to be either cracked or moist. I would try cracking it just a little bit to not damage it too much. But
do I take off the little cap or no?
Yes.
Okay, take off cap and slightly crack the kernel.
Right. I mean, if you think about how acorns get spread naturally, it's they get eaten by animals or they get spread around. They get a little crack in them so that the most nuts need to have the outer shell cracked a little bit so that the seed can germinate.
I will do that. And can I ask another question?
Okay.
We have a wetland adjacent to our planted area, and I've planted over the years evergreens, an assortment of evergreens. And this year we lost three of them because the wetland was so wet that it oozed up into the ground around the trees, and the trees were roots were underwater for about 3 months, spring and summer.
Yep.
Now my question is, if we were to plant something on the edge of the wetland, just beyond the trees, what kind of a tree or a bush would absorb water to get it out of the ground to protect those evergreens that remain? Would a willow help?
Well, there are a number of willows that would do that. The native willows will do that, but the low-growing willow spreads quite a bit. We've been talking about red osier dogwood is a wetland, sort of wetland shrub that might help. Elderberries might help because they'll pull out water. You can use wet prairie plants or sedge meadow plants instead of using shrubs and have that around. Are they arborvitae or what kind of?
No, they're spruces, firs, pines.
Well, I didn't hear the first one.
Spruces.
Spruces. Well, they're just not going to.
No.
You know,
pines,
they're not going to.
A fir died. A pine is looking different.
Yeah. I mean, those just aren't going to do well when it's wet. And I don't know that you're going to be able to plant enough to change the conditions so that they will. I mean, you for a wet area, the only conifer would be black spruce, perhaps tamarack. Or arborvitae, maybe a little hemlock. But you think of the things that grow naturally in wet places. It's not pines.
No, definitely not pines. Thanks, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see. We've got Sarah in Rushford, Minnesota next. Sarah, hello.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I hear a lot of people calling in wanting to know where to find seeds or how to germinate different kinds of seeds, and I'd like to recommend a nursery that sells native plant seeds and plants to transplant into your soil, and that would be Prairie Moon Nursery.
Prairie Moon Nursery.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They're in Winona, Minnesota. They're an excellent nursery. They have a nice website. Gives you a lot of information.
That's www.prairiemoon.com, and it tells very in-depthly how to germinate those seeds and some of the ones that are harder to do, like those woody woodland perennials. You can buy the plant ready to go.
Prairie Moon Nursery.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Sarah.
Yep, you bet.
Appreciate it. And let's go to Jean and Amory then. Jean, hello to you.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I was calling, it sounds like another nursery plug, but I was calling for one of your callers was looking for inexpensive rain garden plants.
Yes.
And we have a nursery here in Amory called Dragonfly Gardens that specializes in natives. And you can buy flats, 50 to 60 plants for about $35, I think it is.
Yeah.
But I just thought I'd, you know, share that because I've bought plants there before and I thought they were really good quality and quite a huge variety of native plants.
And again, the name is?
Dragonfly Gardens.
Dragonfly Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Jean.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call.
That's a new one to me.
All right. We'll have to look that one up.
Yep.
I wonder if they have a website. We'll have to take a check on that. Dragonfly Nursery. Lou in Milwaukee, your turn.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, could you educate me quickly on elderberry? I have never seen elderberry. Recently, I've seen elderberry growing in places where I've never seen it before, and it just takes off like a rocket from nothing.
Well, this year it seems to be doing very well. I think maybe all the moisture we had in parts of the state in June helped it. It likes light shade to open sun. It can tolerate some moisture. You often see it growing along roadside ditches. But you can even see it on uplands or partial shady oak savannas or even partial shady oak woodlands. It doesn't produce as many berries if it's shaded too much. There are two elderberries, actually, but the common one, the black elderberry, is the one I'm speaking of.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Joe in Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Two questions. One, I have a hydrangea, one that's planted in the ground, another one in a pot that is a foot and a half tall. What do I do if I want to keep them for the winter? Do I plant them both and cover them? That's my first question. And my second, I have some runaway raspberry bushes that unfortunately I planted right next to an arborvitae tree, and it's next to a stockade fence, and the raspberry bushes have gone up and over this 12-foot fence, and I almost have to get a stepladder to get to them. Which do I cut? Which do I transplant? Or could I transplant some of the raspberry bushes to a different place? Do I cut them down? What?
What do you think?
Well, I can't help with the hydrangeas, and I'm not very good with the raspberries because what I just deal with wild raspberries, and I much prefer the black raspberries instead of the blackberries. They're not going to go over a 12-foot fence in my condition, so I can't help you out. I mean, you certainly can cut them back, and they'll grow from the roots. Raspberries like to put their end of their cane in the ground and grow a new plant. So you could do that, let it start a new one, and then cut the cane on the other end. But I would go to Extension Publications or Extension Information for both of your questions.
All right. Can't help you out too much there. And let's see. We've got Matt in Milwaukee. Do you have a quick question?
Hi. I have a quick question about how to germinate wild strawberry seeds. Do I need to... I was listening to the show and you said, you know, to try to replicate the natural conditions, and I know obviously they get eaten.
You're really breaking up a little bit here, but what about wild strawberry from seed?
Wild strawberry from seed would probably be, you know, separate, get the seeds off of the berry. That's the most important thing for anything that has a berry, to separate them and then try them. But they're really easy to, they'll spread. You only need a few plants for them to spread. And I would just like to go back to the woman that called about having the oval sedge and stuff. There's some really wonderful sedges and grasses that the nurseries are starting to carry that we never had available to us before that are beautiful and good examples of things. She made a perfect example of something that the reason you grow native plants is so you can reduce mowing, reduce energy use, reduce water.
Molly, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Molly Fifield-Murray, Director of Outreach and Education Programs for the UW-Madison Arboretum. We'll have her back and we'll talk with her again. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.